good talk coming. Come on back, sit down. We arranged the rain. You know, Jeff gave a false story. The real story is too many people left early yesterday. We're making sure you stay. I'd like to thank Information Security for sponsoring today's luncheon. They're media partners with Black Hat for several years. They focus on current computer security issues. Their columnists are world-recognized leaders, like Jay Beal, who worked with us earlier this week with a tutorial, as well as presenting earlier today. Information Security is published by TechTarget, which is one of my personal favorites because of the definitions and resource information. It's a good way of befuddling some of my students since I play a professor at night. What I'd like to do now is introduce our keynote speaker. Marcus Sachs is a cyber program director in the Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection Directorate for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He'll have another story for the rain, too. And he's responsible for developing the implementation plan for the President's National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace. Mark was previously Director for Communication Infrastructure Protection in the White House Office of Cyberspace Security and was a staff member of the President's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board. Mark retired from the U.S. Army with 20 years experience. Love people who can retire and collect that paycheck for not working. He specialized in the later half of his career in computer network operations, systems automation, and information technology. His final assignment with the Army was with the Defense Department's Joint Task Force in Computer Network Operations, where he was a senior operations analyst and technical director. I give you Mark Sachs.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Good afternoon. This is really a great opportunity to come back to Las Vegas and to Black Hat. So many years I've sat out in the audience and have participated, and now they have the opportunity to stand up here and tell you a little bit about what we're doing at Homeland Security. I hope each and every one of you have taken the opportunity to meet others here, to trade business cards, to get to know the rest of the family. It's such a unique place. Just a moment ago, Kevin Mitnick sits down next to me and starts cursing his telephone because it doesn't work. So you know, what a great place, right? What I'd like to do is set the stage and build a story about what has been happening in the United States over the last 20 years, leading us up to the events of September 11th. And then I'm going to talk about what we're doing in the federal government to increase the security posture of the nation, as well as what we're doing internationally. If we look back a couple of years, Dr. Rice, who was the National Security Advisor to the President, was talking to an international security policy forum, and she made a very interesting observation. She said that, talking about defending in cyberspace, that that mission is just like classical deterrence. Make yourself more secure than somebody else, the bad guys go after those who are less defended. She also made the observation that the first thing we really have to do is determine whether or not we have a problem, and admit that we have a problem. Much like somebody who has an addiction or some abusive characteristic, admit there's a problem and move forward. The President, and this quote was taken before September 11th, was also addressing in this case, a North American Council meeting, recognized that things have changed in the United States and internationally. No longer are we a bipolar world with the Soviet Union and the United States facing off. But in fact, what we have is several smaller countries now that are providing the basis of the largest threats to the United States. And in this case, what they're developing are nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, and he makes the quote and talks about cyber terrorism. So even the President had recognized that this was a problem. Well, just in the last few weeks, I'm sure many of you have been watching the challenge that showed up over the 4th of July weekend, a defacers challenge. We had hoped that this would pass by unnoticed. Unfortunately, some companies picked up on it and got into the press. It probably got a little bit too much press coverage. There were several challenges that weekend. Most of you were following, and in fact, they blew past with little disruption on the internet. But these types of challenges are now a routine part of our life, and as InfoSec professionals, this is something that we deal with daily. We also had a revelation a few weeks ago that a graduate student or a doctoral student in doing his PhD research had uncovered an ability to map the infrastructure of the United States using open source access. And it created a very well-defined document showing where all the fiber optic runs went, all the central offices, how the telecommunications system connects together, and was ready to publish that information, but that now has garnered the attention of the federal government, and we're still working out what's the proper way to do this publishing. In the last couple, 3 weeks, we've had some serious vulnerabilities from both Cisco and from Microsoft, and no sooner have the vulnerabilities been announced than, in fact, exploits are showing up. In this case, exploit for the Cisco systems and exploits for Microsoft. The screen's probably hard to see towards the rear, but for those of you who are up front, you can see on the right-hand side the use of the DCOM overflow. This is LSD's solution. I was running this against my daughter's computer just to see if it would work. I've got two kids, and the younger of the two doesn't like to patch her system, so I went ahead and ran the exploit against it. It ran fine, got her attention so she could see that from a Linux box I'm reading her C drive. That disturbed her enough to where she disconnected herself and cleaned up her act a little bit. Sometimes that's what it takes. It's just showing to people that your systems can be broken into and they are vulnerable. Let's turn the clock back about 20 years. In 1982, the United States infrastructure, communications infrastructure, was largely based on an AT&T system. Monolithic, circuit switched, copper-based, although there was some fiber optic coming along, microwave for long-distance hauls. But in general, if you wanted to do anything with telecommunications, you contacted AT&T. The federal government was pressured into breaking up AT&T. So a judge in January of 82 directed the divestiture of the company, creating what we call the baby bells. This has resulted in a very different infrastructure today with many companies. The same sort of thing may happen to Microsoft someday, where we might break them up or they get forced to break up into baby bills, possibly. After AT&T broke up, we've now seen a very different communications infrastructure, very diverse. Circuit switch, packet switch, satellite, wireless, fiber optic cable to the home, individual devices, we probably all carry them with us. Now, some may argue that the breakup of AT&T was very harmful to AT&T. Others may argue that this is the best thing that ever happened. The fact is, it did happen, and it set into motion the situation we have today with multiple carriers, multiple ways of communicating, buildings that are connected to both Verizon and Sprint and AT&T and other carriers at the same time, instead of just having one option. In the late 1990s, there was another turning point. In 1997, a presidential commission published a report showing that the critical infrastructures of the United States were very, very vulnerable. And at about the same time, a classified exercise took place inside the Defense Department where it was proven that from the outside, from the internet, average citizens, hackers, others could gain access deep within DoD networks. Now, this exercise at the time was classified. It's known as Eligible Receiver. The results of that exercise were briefed to general officers in the Pentagon, and at the time they looked at it and said, well, this is largely theoretical. It was conducted by the NSA. It was done with experts in controlled situations. A real hacker won't do this. In February of 1998, just a few months later, Iraq has crossed one of the no-fly zones, and we're raining a little bit of steel on Baghdad, putting them back in their box. And about that same time, some Air Force system administrators uncover evidence of an intrusion in not one but several Air Force sites. Again, the generals in the Pentagon gather to discuss this, and one of them recalls that just several months later, Eligible Receiver had shown that this was possible. So now the theoretical was becoming practical. And the blood ran cold because their thought at the time was, could this be Iraq conducting a counterstrike against the United States or against the Air Force? Let me put that down and it'll quit shaking. There we go. Okay. All right, we got the technology. There we go. And in fact, what might be going on is that using a form of asymmetric warfare. All right. That's one heck of a lightning strike, isn't it? Yeah. We're going to assume this is a microphone. Okay. Do we have a backup? Okay. Oh, we have rain coming through. Imagine that. Okay, so now we have no interference. So we looked at what happened with what we then called Solar Sunrise, and that really got the DoD's attention. That in fact somebody could come in from the internet deep inside Air Force networks and cause damage. Now what happened? Was it really Iraq. No, it wound up being a couple of teenagers in California, but there was an international connection, so there was a continuity. Hello. Okay, we're back. And we're still going to play with the microphones here. The FBI and others uncovered a fairly massive intrusion into not just Defense Department networks, but Energy Department, commercial, the industrial base. That became known as Moonlight Maze. That investigation is still underway today. We still have not gained attribution as to who is breaking into these networks. Also that year, the Joint Task Force for Computer Network Defense was formed to take a look at how to actually conduct cyber warfare, turning on a brand new chapter of the Defense Department. In 1998, the White House issued a presidential decision directive under President Clinton that created brand new organizations, took a new look at how to defend the infrastructures of the United States, and set in motion what has become today the Department of Homeland Security, although back then nobody was using those words. Critical infrastructures were identified, gas and oil, water systems, banking and finance, and different parts of the government were assigned to be in charge of working with those critical infrastructures. One way we did this, and these continue today, was through the use of information sharing and analysis centers. These are locations where various parts of infrastructures can come together and pool knowledge and then share it amongst themselves. So an intrusion in the financial sector can be shared with information in the transportation sector, but without destroying any of the confidentiality of the information or without revealing who the company was that was broken in. So all these things had been going on through the 1990s leading up to where we thought we had a fairly secure infrastructure in the United States. Y2K had come and gone with no problems. It was the general thought at the time that any attack on the U.S. by one of these smaller countries would be via cyberspace. That was our soft underbelly. This is where it was going to come from. So on the morning of September 11th, when three airplanes fly into buildings and one more goes down in a field in Pennsylvania, we were very shocked inside the federal government because the attack did not come from a cyber dimension, but in fact was a physical attack. A big eye-opener. How was it that we missed all this physical vulnerability and we were so focused on cyber? So since then, now we've seen a big change in the way we're doing business. Cyber is still important, but we're much more interested in what happens physically. As we started digging into what happened on September 11th, we found that there can be a pretty good link drawn between the physical and the cyber world. I don't know if for those of you up front can probably see my dot there. What I'm highlighting is the World Trade Center complex, Trade Center 2 and Trade Center 1, and this is a map of Lower Manhattan. Right next door to it is the Verizon building, the downtown central office for Lower Manhattan. And several blocks away was the New York Stock Exchange. Now the reason I'm showing this is we had the collapse of several buildings in New York City. But the collapse of those buildings had an effect on the infrastructure, the communications infrastructure of Lower Manhattan that none of us had predicted. Looking at Ground Zero from the air, this is a reverse view of that graphic. We can see the remains of the World Trade Center towers, and this is the Verizon building standing right next door. World Trade Center 7 stood next to the Verizon building, and it fell later in the day after the first two towers fell. When 7 came down, it fell up against the side of the Verizon building. Here's a close-up picture, and you can see some of the debris up to the fourth story. Parts of Trade Center 7 also went into the ground, large steel girders cutting down through the sidewalk, cutting steam pipes, electrical pipes, fiber optic bundles, other communication systems. And if you imagine underneath the World Trade Center area, millions of gallons of water are being poured in to put out fires. You've got steam lines and water lines that are broken. The Hudson River is trying to come back in. And all at the same time, we're trying to keep communications up. Inside the building, if you look at one of the switching rooms, you can see that switches themselves, the racks have been destroyed. But one thing that amazed the Verizon engineers was at least one of the large switches was hanging outside the window, literally by its power cord and communications cable, and still switching phone calls. Unbelievable, hanging out. Underneath the Pentagon, directly where the aircraft hit, was access points where a bank of routers sit. Those routers continued to run, even with the aircraft on top of it. They went to backup power, and then an employee crawled in with an orange extension cord and provided emergency power to the router configuration for several days until they could get the aircraft out and dig down to it. So the hardware works. We can still keep these things working as long as we can get power and comms to it, even with an airplane laying on top or with other buildings collapsing around it. Back in New York City, the challenge now for Verizon was, if everything underground is flooded and there's mass confusion underneath, how do we bring communications back and restore lower Manhattan? This is a picture at street level. If you look closely, you can see the base of the street light. This is not inside. Most of lower Manhattan looked like this for several days and weeks later. And many interesting stories came out of this. Help from other companies that came in to help Verizon. AT&T, for example, we're still having a lot of microphone problems. That was on purpose. Okay. There we go. So what we learned in New York City was that the physical infrastructure and the cyber infrastructure are very, very closely tied together. In the case of the stock exchange, as that building was being wired over the years, many diverse paths were brought in for communications, for computer communications. Multiple carriers, multiple fiber optic routes. But as carriers merged and as routes were bartered and traded between them, it turned out that most of the routes had converged down to one path connecting between the stock exchange and the Verizon building. So if the Verizon building suffered damage that it did, the stock market went offline. Had those original other circuits still been in business, the stock exchange could have kept running. This was a hard lesson for many people in lower Manhattan to find out that when you thought you had diversity, in fact, everything was all in one fiber optic bundle or in one trench. We found that telephone systems fail, obviously, when the cables are cut. Wireless systems fail when antennas fall down. Wireless systems also fail when many people are trying to use their cell phones to call back to their parents and their loved ones to let them know that they're fine. But those who are connected on the internet and were using fiber optic systems that did not route through Verizon, the internet continued to work. They used instant messaging, they used email, they used other means, chat, to inform their family and friends that they were doing fine. Following September 11th, the federal government decided to create a Homeland Security Department. It started off with the Office of Homeland Security, which developed some strategies, and ultimately the department itself. The department is where I work, and we are based on three main objectives. The primary one is to prevent any future terrorist attacks. Now, my world is all cyber, so we are looking at how to protect the cyber infrastructure from terrorist attacks using the computer networks. There are others who are working on the chemical industries, transportation borders, etc. The way we're organized, and this is a very simple line chart, no government briefing is complete without a line chart, of course, is four large divisions. The one on the left, information analysis and infrastructure protection, is where we work. The other is emergency preparedness and response, is much like the old FEMA. That's the organization that if we have an earthquake, a hurricane, or other type of natural disaster, can bring government resources to bear on solving the problems. Science and technology for research. And border transportation and security, those are the men and women that you see at your airports, at the frontier, at the customs offices, and such. Inside of IAIP, as we call it, we're broken into two groups. Those who do information analysis, which is largely could be thought of as an intelligence function, risk reduction, and those who work with the infrastructure owners, determining ways to reduce vulnerabilities, get early warning out if an attack is coming, and then work to minimize any consequences should something happen. Inside of infrastructure protection is where we've placed the National Cybersecurity Division, the very group that I work for. Our main purpose is divided into three functional areas, identified down on the bottom. The first is that we're looking at identifying specific risks, threats, and vulnerabilities to the cyber infrastructure of the United States, and how do we reduce them. The second is to track incidents in real time and working with other governments, working with industry, working with state and local officials to address those issues and work through them. And finally, to do outreach and training, to work with the universities on curricula, to work with companies that need help getting security going, and to raise the general awareness. We base what our organization is doing on one of two strategies that were published in February. The one on the left, the National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace, is more or less our doctrinal manual. I'm going to talk through what the priorities in there and how we are implementing them. The one I show on the right is for the physical protection. It's a companion strategy. Both of these strategies are available online. The best place to find them is at whitehouse.gov. Now, if you type in whitehouse.com, I'm not going to guarantee what comes back. I hear some of you laughing, which means you've gone to whitehouse.com before. So go to whitehouse.gov/homeland, and you can find both of these strategies. Please download and take a look at them. We welcome your input, and in fact, we're going to be renewing these strategies annually or maybe every 2 years. The strategy to secure cyberspace is a unique document because never before have we tried to put together a roadmap, not a how-to guide, not a step-by-step, here's how you lock down your computer, or here's how you put ACLs into a firewall, but a larger strategic look at moving the nation forward to a more secure infrastructure. We wrote it together with that companion strategy on physical protection, and we wrote it with contributions from industry and private sector. Very little of the language that's in the strategy was written by a government employee. Most of the language was written by the private sector. All we did was bring it together and make the sentences flow. We do want to change the strategy from time to time because we know our understanding will also change over the years. Inside the strategy, we make a case that, as Dr. Rice pointed out, recognize there's a problem and then move forward with fixing it. Our nation is dependent on cyberspace. We can't go back. This is now how we work. This is the way we live. It's our environment. The threats that come at cyberspace, though, have many different types. There's script kiddies, there's nation states, there's terrorists, there's espionage, all types of threats, but the vulnerabilities that these threats use to get into our systems are pretty much the same. So one message that we push is while many organizations like to focus on the threat, why not focus on fixing vulnerabilities? As system administrators, we should all know exactly what's vulnerable with our networks. We should know where our exposures are. If we reduce, again, our exposure, make somebody else more vulnerable than we are, those threats will go to the easy targets. Don't make yourself low-hanging fruit. We also recognize that government by itself cannot secure cyberspace. This is not like a Defense Department provide national security overseas. Cyberspace is a shared resource, and security of it is something that we all do together. Inside the strategy, there are five priorities. I'll go through each of these very quickly. The first one focuses on creating a 24/7 response system, something that if an event emerges, we can quickly work with those people in the private sector who are mitigating it, the Tier 1 and Tier 2 ISPs, software providers, hardware providers, come up with a quick solution and coordinate that activity so that the guidance can be promulgated, work with the press, work with our international partners. We're doing part of this by building what we call the CWIN network, that Cyber Warning and Information Network. This network is extending from the federal government out to several dozen private sector operation centers and is being paid for by the federal government. This is completely free to the private sector. We'll use CWIN as an out-of-band network, does not connect to the internet, does not connect to the public phone networks, and this is a way that we can communicate should there be large catastrophic outages on the internet. The second thing we're looking at is reducing threats and vulnerabilities. Part of this, of course, has to do with working with the software companies, promoting the trusted security, promoting the idea that software should only do what software is designed to do, working to increase physical security of central offices, peering points, and other places where there's a physical presence of the internet. The third piece we're looking at in terms of awareness and training is to promote this idea that security is a cultural mindset. The entire world now has gone digital. We're not the only ones. There is a global mindset that says we need to have security globally on the internets in order to move forward. So quite a bit of our outreach is working with the not just the private sector, but with our international partners and with this global view towards increasing security awareness. Of course, we can't promulgate all these great ideas about security without first securing our systems, and this is a big issue for us. The federal government's networks, state networks, local networks in cities and towns and municipalities also have to be secure. It's one thing for us to publish guidance. It's another thing for us to go back and eat our dog food. So we are really, really, really putting a lot of interest in making sure our own networks are secure, and so that they can serve as an example, both for enterprise-wide as well as small, on how you can do security at a installation or campus network. Finally, the fifth priority is international. How we do our relationships with others. How do we gain attribution on attacks coming from other countries, law enforcement interactions and stuff. And of course, promoting that global culture of security that's now catching on worldwide. Over the next couple of slides, I'm going to show you what's happening on the international front. It all started off with a meeting in Europe a couple of years ago with the Council of Europe, getting together and deciding on a list of cybercrime convention points. Now, none of what's in this convention is technical. All of it has to do with how we use the internet and what should be considered legal on the internet so that we can adopt a common body of knowledge for legal versus illegal. Infringements of copyright, child pornography, network security violations, that's the focus of this convention. The United States participated, even though we're not a European country, and our Senate has been considering whether we should ratify this convention, make it part of United States law. The Japanese are going to also participate and ratify it. I believe three European countries so far have already ratified, and several others are going to do that this year or next. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development last year issued a set of security guidelines, again, non-technical, written for managers, focusing on awareness and responsibility, risk assessments, security design, things that managers can use, governments can use, leaders can use to bring security to their corporate networks and to their enterprise networks. The Asian Pacific Economic Council, APEC, had a meeting last fall to determine a way ahead for the Asian Pacific cultures. They also enacted a leader's statement, of which there are several bullets inside of it applying to cyberspace. Things such as enacting cyber laws that are just like the European Council of Council of Europe's Cybercrime Convention, creating high-tech cybercrime units, single points of contacts, national certs. The United Nations has also issued a resolution, essentially taking what APEC has done and what the Council on Europe has done and made this now a United Nations General Assembly resolution. So many things are happening globally, not just in the United States, and of course it's up to us here in the U.S. to plug into that and not try and be on our own developing our own mechanisms for security. If we look at where the internet came from, it was birthed here. 1969, I think we all know the story of ARPANET, four computers connected together for academic purposes, slowly grew to include government, other science and research throughout the 70s, largely just academic and government military focused. In the 1980s, we started adding commercial interests. In the 1990s, the general public got interested as the World Wide Web was born, and today it's a part of our culture and will never go back. But today's internet is based upon protocols and an understanding of technology rooted in the early 70s. One of the famous quotes I heard at DARPA last year was that they're now ready to quit using the prototype and start building the actual internet. And it's probably a true statement because today's internet really is a prototype. It's still based on what we had back in the early 1970s. So we built this internet. It's our responsibility to secure it. Is that a fact? We have to ask that of ourselves. But if we want to secure the internet, how do we do it? Will IPv4 do what we need, or do we need to move to IPv6? Does it provide capabilities? That's a very, very religious question. Some feel that IPv6 gives us nothing in terms of security that we can't do in IPv4. In many cases, that's true, but one thing V6 does give us, is the opportunity to be fully accountable for every address on the internet. In other words, every connection point to the internet can have a unique address. That doesn't mean that every individual can be tracked. You can still have anonymity as an individual, but the device can be known on the internet. We need to have network services that are dependable, routing systems that don't break, naming systems that can scale to, if we move to V6, a world where there's 10 to the 38th possible addresses. How do we scale today's DNS to something like that? We need to have software that's trustworthy. How many of you still run old copies of Office 97? And you remember the Excel spreadsheet where if you highlight a particular cell, hit a series of keys at the same time, what happens? That pops a flight simulator. So why does a flight simulator pop up inside of a spreadsheet? What else is built into that spreadsheet? What other features that we don't know about? Trustworthy software means I get what I pay for. If I want presentation graphics, that's all I get. If I want a word processor, that's all I get. I don't get spyware. I don't get adware. I don't get all the other things packaged in behind it. We also need to have a PKI, a public key infrastructure that works. We've been dreaming for this for many years. There's been many attempts at making it work. Key management seems to be the key to bringing that success. We also need to think about building new networks from the ground up. Secure. For those of you who are responsible for building brand new networks and buildings, or brand new networks for brand new companies, do you put security at the beginning of the architectural plan, or does it always fall at the end? Is it more important to wire the building first and then go back and figure out how to defend it? Or do you build security in from the ground up? We need to worry about clueless users. Those millions of users who connect to broadband, cable, or DSL modems in their home, leave their computer on all the time, run no firewall, don't update their antivirus software, if they have antivirus software, don't update their systems, leave themselves vulnerable at the end of a fat connection for malware, for bots, for other types of software to get into their systems. How do we do that? How do we design an internet that, much like the highway system, if you make a mistake on an interstate highway and your car gets out of control, generally the highway is designed to push you off to the side through safety rails or other types of features, so your mistake can just play itself out in the grass, and the only thing you hurt is yourself and your car. Well, how do we do that on the internet? How do we take somebody that doesn't know what they're doing and create something in the internet where they can be shunted off to the side and play out their mistakes without hurting anybody else? Can we do that? Is that possible? The next bullet I have on there is kind of contentious, and this has to do with certification. Many of us have MCSEs, CISSPs, Novell licenses, and such. But how many of us are accountable for what we design? If we label ourselves as security professionals and we design a security plan for an organization, and that organization gets broken into and it turns out that it was our plan that was wrong, are you willing to be held financially accountable for your mistakes? Are you willing to put your name on the line? That's the type of level we need to start thinking about in terms of certifications. Can we make ourselves liable and responsible for our work? Or are we just going to hang something pretty on the wall and say, I studied, I went to Learning Tree, I did this CRAM course, and I got my license, and here it hangs. It took a long time for the engineering communities and others to get to this level of professionalism. I think that's something that we in the InfoSec world also need to look at over the coming years. Best practices are being published. I've listed several sites here. I'm going to make sure that this presentation is available through Black Hat, so if you want to download it later, you can look at these URLs. But I would encourage looking at these best practices. If you've got system administrators that don't know where to start, these are some good locations for top 10 lists, do this first, do this second, step-by-step instructions on securing networks. The last thing we need to look at is actually defining what security is. What word do we use to describe a secure internet? Security means different things to different people. In some countries, security means blocking all content from the United States because we're evil. In some countries, security means blocking everything that's in English because we want our language to be the only thing that's seen. In other countries, it's more of a technical focus in terms of keeping networks up and running and making sure we have a quality of service. So security itself needs to be defined. Finally, I want to emphasize that security is shared, and it starts with individuals. It starts with each one of you. Your own personal computer, your pocket PC, your Palm, your cell phone that is internet-enabled, have you made sure that the world around you is as secure as you can make it? Are all the patches applied? Are you running the latest version of antivirus software with signatures? Have you done that to your personal connection to the internet? And once that's been taken care of, have you done it with those people that are around you, such as your children, your wife, your family, your mom and dad? And once that's finished, have you taken it to your workspace and made sure your coworkers? These circles will continue out and eventually they bump into each other. This culture of security is something that we have if we're going to move forward in the 21st century with a digital economy, with all the things we'd like to do, with doing online trading, online banking, rental car, flight arrangements, everything on the web. If we're going to make that work, security is of course the key. So what I want to leave you with is the mindset that says, while the internet may be 30 years old in the version that we know it, we are the only generation that gets the first shot at doing it right. We are the ones who are going to build into this internet what it's going to look like for years and years and years to come. Will there be an internet 100 years from now? Of course. Will there be an internet 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now? What will civilizations look back on, back to the beginning of the 21st century, and say that generation really knew what they were doing? They built a very good, secure internet that we can build on top of. Or they were absolutely clueless, and look how much money we're having to spend to go back in and re-engineer. Roman roads, 2,000 years old, still exist throughout Europe. I doubt many of those road builders thought that those infrastructures would still be here 2,000 years ago. So take this upon yourself as you go forward through the rest of Black Hat, and for those of you that are going on to DEF CON this weekend, what can I do as an individual? What is my contribution towards raising the security of the world around us and contributing to this global culture of security? So with that, I close. Please, if anybody has any questions, let me know. It's hard in here to answer questions, so just come see me afterwards. And thank you again for coming, and stay safe.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, we'll start back up in about 20 minutes over in the other building. For those of you who are going to DEF CON tomorrow over the weekend, make sure you bring your badge, your DEF CON ticket, and an ID. We want to make sure the badge belongs to you. Thank you.